Okay, so first of all, I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me to this beautiful place here. Actually, I almost got a sunburn while I prepared the talk here. So we are interested in bacterial molecular motors. And the motors we work most with are type 4 pili. Now, type 4 pili are not classical motors. They are polymers that extend by about a micrometer from a bacterial cell. So this would be an electron micrograph of a bacterium here. And these pili are about 6 nanometers thick. Now, our favorite bacterium was called Neisseria gonorrhea. Neisseria gonorrhea is the causative agent of gonorrhea and conjunctivitis. And in Neisseria, the pili support multiple functions. For example, the pili are essential for adhesion to cell surfaces or also to abiotic surfaces. And this is particularly important when they want to adhere to their host. So this would be an epithelial cell layer. And here you see the bacteria adhere to their host. And this makes the pili really essential virulence factors. So there have been experiments of volunteers where people were infected with either wild-type strain or Pylos minor strain. And those who were infected with Pylos minor usually didn't develop triple. But these pili are not only essential for adherence to surfaces, but also for making the bacteria cluster together. So here you see a typical shape of a bacterial microcolony, which is adhered to an epithelial cell layer. And they always form these round and dome-shaped microcolonies. Now, if you think you would let the cells grow further, then you would get biofilms. And there again, the pili are essential for developing the architecture of a biofilm. But then the pili also mediate the kind of controversial phenotype of clustering, which is spreading. So they are essential for a kind of surface motility, which is also called twitching motility. And finally, they are essential for transformation, which is one kind of horizontal gene transfer. And there they make part of a machine that binds external DNA and pulls it through the cell envelope. The reason why we very much like to work with Neisseria gonorrhea is not that it's a pathogen, but the reason is that it has no other motility system. It has very few ways of regulating genes. It has a very small genome, expresses the pili all the time, and there is no chemotaxis and no quorum sensing.
Are these pili, is this some specialty of these guys, or are they sort of very...
No, I'm going through various species now, and you will see that they have different functions in different species. So another bacterium where pili are very well studied is Pseudomonas aeruginosa. This is another human pathogen which causes lung infections. And there again, the pili are involved in adhesion, motility, and biofilm formation. But here, one difference is that the bacteria are rod-shaped, so they make the pili essentially at one pole. And for Pseudomonas, Jeffries Kirk and Howard Burke have very nicely shown a couple of years ago how these pili can mediate surface motility. And for this, they fluorescently labeled the pili. If you look, I hope you can see them, otherwise I have to turn down the light. And there you see how the pili can really mediate motility. So what they do essentially is they extend, and then they attach to a surface, and then as they retract, they pull the cell body forward. So in a way, they act as grappling hooks, which can mediate cellular movement by a cycle of extension, adhesion, and retraction. So for these bacteria, there are other motility systems, and they also can undergo lipid-based chemotaxis. And then the third species where pili have been studied in detail is Myxococcus xanthus. Now, Myxococcus is a bacterium that lives in soil. And there again, the pili mediate motility. But they have developed a very weird kind of motility where they go in one direction for 8 minutes. And then after 8 minutes, they reverse polarity and walk in the other direction. So they have a clock that is somehow coupled to motility. And this will then lead to the, first of all, to the formation of very complex patterns. So these have been called accordion waves. And this happens usually upon starvation, and then this will form a fruiting body, and then in the fruiting body the bacteria can sporulate. And you see this is a bacterium with a very large genome, and this has many control units. So it's a, and this is probably due to the fact that it has such a complex lifestyle.
So how can you make out of going back and forth?
No, it's not obvious. There are a lot of theories. So there are a lot of theories from the George Auster lab. So when you have a single bacterium, it goes back and forth. But if you have many bacteria, and I'll show you a couple of waves later on, and then the bacteria communicate with each other. And they have two ways of communicating that are known. And one is through extracellular polysaccharides. And then they can also exchange proteins that control the pullous machinery from one bacterium to the other. And this way they can coordinate and they reflect each other, and then they form these waves. Okay, and then just to give you a more or less complete picture of about pili, I am not going to come back to these bacteria later on. There are also cyanobacteria that use the type 4 pili to undergo phototaxis. So this is an assay where a microcolony has been created here. And then a light gradient is put from the top, and then the bacteria use the type 4 pili to move towards the light. And then finally, there are bacteria that can use iron oxides as an energy source. And one example is Geobacter sulfureductans. And these are pili of Geobacter, and this is iron trioxide. And somehow the bacteria can shuttle electrons from the membrane to the iron trioxide and then reduce the iron trioxide. And the pili are somehow involved in this process, and there are experiments that seem to hint that they're really nanowires. This is not clear. Okay, so far we know that the type 4 pilus is really ubiquitous amongst phylogenetically diverse bacteria, and it supports different functions. Now, so far we have not done any evolutionary experiments, so please don't search for any evolutionary terminology here. But we have characterized the biophysical properties of these pili in various different species. And I've shown you that the pili really support different phenotypes and different species. So I thought it would be interesting to look at what point the biophysical properties have adapted differently to support these different phenotypes. And we're going to start at the single molecule level. So we will look at a single pilus and characterize the dynamics. And then we will compare this between different species. And the work that I'm going to show you is work by a former PhD student, by Martin Clausen, and now Rainer Kura has taken over. And we have a long-standing collaboration with Mike Kumi from Oslo University there. Now, about 30 years of genetics have identified roughly 20 proteins that are somehow involved in pilus biogenesis and dynamics. But I would like to introduce only the most important ones. So the pilus is a helical polymer, which extends about a micron from the outer surface. The subunits are P-shaped with a hydrophilic surface and a hydrophobic tail, which is inserted into the inner membrane. And then there is one ATPase called POLF, which is essential for the polymerization of the pilus. So we think that whenever this binds, the pilus polymerizes. And POLF has an antagonist called POLT. And POLT is essential for depolymerization of the pilus. Right. So we think that whenever POLT binds to the base of the pilus depolymerizes. For the pilin subunits, there are several crystal structures out there. I would just like to show you that this hydrophobic tail is relatively well conserved. whereas the hydrophilic surface, which is actually responsible for the interaction with the outside world, is highly variable between the different bacterial species. Okay, so now how can we characterize the dynamics of a single pilus? So what we would like to measure is the rate at which it polymerizes and depolymerizes and the force that it can generate. And the way to do this is, the principle is very simple. So we just immobilize the bacterium at a glass cover slide, and then we can watch it in a light microscope. And then we approach a little bead in a laser trap. Is everybody familiar with laser traps? No? Okay. So a laser trap is basically, you use an optical microscope, and then you have a laser beam which is focused through the objective into the image plane, and then a dielectric object such as a small bead are always pulled into the center of the laser trap where you have the highest light intensity. And now, if a pilus binds, or first of all, we can detect the position of the bead in the laser trap with high accuracy on the order of 3 nanometers. This is a black line here. And then we wait until a pilus binds and retracts. And now it pulls the bead out of the center of the laser trap. And now what we can measure is this deflection. And this deflection is proportional to the optical restoring force, which pulls the bead back into the center of the laser trap. So we can also measure the force. And now we want to characterize the dynamics at a constant force. And for this, we keep the deflection constant just by moving the bacterium with respect to the bead. And then from the movement of the bacterium, we directly get the retraction and elongation of a single pilus. So the red curve gives us the length change of the pilus as a function of time. Okay, and now we have characterized this in a lot of detail, but I think one of the most striking things to us was that the velocity during a pulse retraction is really bimodal. So we have one mode at about 2 microns per second and one mode at about 1 micron per second. So this is a bimodal system somehow. And the other striking feature, I think, is the generation of very high forces. So we can measure the maximum force that the pilus can generate just by looking at the deflection as a function of time when we do not have a force clamp. And as the force of the optical tweezer builds up, the velocity decreases until finally the motor cannot work anymore. And this is what we call the stalling force, or more or less the maximum force of the motor. And when we plot a histogram of stalling forces, we find this is larger than 100 piconewtons. And this really makes it the strongest linear motor that we know of. So let's just look at these two biophysical properties. And then we wanted to know what happens if, for example, we exchange the subunit from Neisseria, the pilon subunit. So we thought if the motor needs a really tight fit, then the structure should matter.
What prevents the
pilus
to detach from the bead?
Oh, it does detach.
It does?
Yes.
So you lose the measurement?
Yes, definitely. Uh-huh. Okay, so what we did was we got a mutant from Maikumi where he had exchanged the pilon subunit, pil E, by the pilon subunit, pil A, from Pseudomonas aeruginosa. So the way to do this is just to make a deletion mutant of pil E in Neisseria gonorrhea and then insert a gene for pil A. And now we have Neisseria gonorrhea that make pil I from Pseudomonas. And then again, we measured force generation and velocity. And what we find is that those are really comparable. So it doesn't really matter whether we exchange units from a different bacterial species. And then, of course, we wanted to look at different bacterial species, and we decided to use Myxococcus xanthus because this has a totally different lifestyle. It's phylogenetically distinct. And then again, what we find is we have a bimodal velocity distribution with one mode at 2 microns per second and one at 1 micron per second. And when we look at the force distribution, we find that these forces are even higher. So both force generation by modality of velocity and the amplitude of the velocities are conserved between the specials. Okay, so it seems that the biophysical properties are well conserved at the level of a single pulse. And so the next thing we looked at was the regulation of velocity. Okay, and then for us the next question was, how are multiple pulli coordinated in one cell? And the phenotype we look at here is movement. So let's say we have a bacterium that makes lots of pulli. Then, of course, if this bacterium wants to use all these pulli to move, they have to coordinate somehow. And what I'm going to show you is mainly the work of a postdoc in our lab, of Claudia Holz, and she got help by Dirk Opitz and Rainer Kure. And Alexander Schmidt helped us with electron microscopy. And then I'll show you one experiment on Myxococcus xanthus here. And this was done by Irina Bolia in Lotte Sogard Andersen's lab in Marburg. And there we only had a small contribution. Okay, so let's start with Myxococcus. I've told you before that Myxo doesn't just move, but it also reverses the direction every 8 minutes. And to look at the movement of individual bacteria within a large population of cells, why don't we see anything here? Okay, let's try again. All right. So what you see here as black dots are individual bacteria that are fluorescently labeled. And they are integrated in a large population of unlabeled bacteria. So this is just so that you see the movement of individual bacteria within a large population of bacteria. And then you see they move back and forth at the individual cell level. And then due to their coordination between bacteria, they form these traveling waves. Okay, so this means that somehow the location of the pili must be controlled. So this means every 8 minutes you need a polar switch between the location of the pili. And here Irina made a fusion between YFP and PIL-T. So just to remind you, PIL-T is the protein that is required for pilus retraction. And then what she finds is that if the bacteria move to in this direction to the lower left, then they must have the pili also at the lower left. And then she finds the PIL-T focus on the lagging pole. So this means at the lagging pole, there is a lot of retraction. All the pili are pulled in. And then when the bacterium reverses its direction, it moves to the upper right, and then you see the PIL-T molecules are again at the lagging pole. In addition, we have shown that PIL-T is relatively dynamic, and therefore our idea is now that most of the PIL-T molecules are at the lagging pole. One or the other PIL-T will diffuse to the leading pole, trigger retractions there, but only a few. And then as the polarity reverses, the most of the PIL-T molecules again go to the lagging pole. So in other words, the individual motors are really highly coordinated through this clock in Myxococcus xanthus. Now what about Neisseria gonorrhea? Neisseria gonorrhea is a round bacterium that has its pili all over the cellular contour. So this means that there is really no way of finding a pole where the bacteria would retract their pili simultaneously. And so we checked that the bacteria can move with 3 pili or with 27 pili. They're always able to move. But then, of course, if they are all attached and they would all retract at the same time, then the bacterium, of course, couldn't move. So we characterize a lot of movies like this, where the bacteria are moving on a glass cover slide, and then we looked at the traces. And we plotted the mean square displacement as a function of time. So these are many curves where we see the mean square displacement as a function of time. And this can very nicely be fitted by a correlated random walk model. And in this model, from this fit, we get an average velocity of 1.6 micrometers per second. This is what we expected. And a correlation time of 1.4 seconds. And this corresponds to multiple pillows retractions. So we know that we need at least three pillows retractions that pull one the bacterium in one direction. So there's really correlation, spatial correlation. Now, how does this depend on the number of pili per cell? So here we have made mutants where we can control the number of pili. This would be the wild type with 7. This undergoes a correlated random walk. And these are mutants where we have 3 or 2 pili, and you see they are really not correlated. And then we find that the velocity does not depend on the number of pili, but the correlation time increases more or less linearly with the number of pili per cell. And this then, of course, means if there are 10 pili which pull simultaneously, then they have to detach very easily from the surface. So we measure the detachment force, and what we get is that usually the detachment force is only 10 piconewtons as compared to about 100 piconewtons that is generated by a single pilus. And this is really a prerequisite for a tug of war-like movement. So what we think at the moment is that we don't need any regulation at the biochemical level, but that stochastical regulation is really sufficient here. So the idea would be that if by a random fluctuation there are just more pili attached to the right than to the left, we have a higher force on the left, which makes the pili detach more easily. And this will then induce a positive feedback because now the force per attachment is even higher. So our data are consistent with this model, and currently we are trying to get a good model for this together with Stefan Klump in Berlin. And then, on the other hand, Myxococcus xanthus is really a control freak. It highly coordinates the generation or the site of generation of pili, and then, of course, they can coordinatedly pull the bacterium in one direction. Okay. So. Now, so far we have looked at the type 4 pilus machine and looked how far do the biophysical properties differ in different specials to support different functions or different phenotypes. But now I would like to ask the question the other way around. So let's say we have a function that is beneficial for a bacterium, and the bacterium has evolved different machines to perform that function. How similar are then the biophysical properties? And the machine that I would like to look at here is the transformation machine. So transformation means the bacterium binds DNA to the cell surface, and then it pulls it through the cell envelope. And then usually the newly newly acquired DNA is integrated into the chromosome. Okay, now, usually the type 4 pilus is part of that machine. It's somehow involved in binding of double-stranded DNA to the cell surface. The DNA is then cleaved, and then one strand becomes degraded, and the other strand is transported through the pore into the interior of the cell. Okay, so this is the picture that we have for Bacillus subtilis, because there the transformation machine was studied best. But this also holds true for Neisseria gonorrhea, so even for gram-negatives, they have a similar machine, although they need a couple of more proteins because there the DNA has to be transported through the outer membrane and then through the inner membrane. So the type 4 pillow system is somehow essential for transformation in all known competent specials, apart from one exception, and this is Helicobacter pylori. And in Helicobacter pylori, there's only one homologous protein, which is the inner membrane channel. So this is called CARMI-C. All the other proteins are adapted from a type 4 secretion system. So, and this type 4 secretion system obviously has been inverted so that proteins are not secreted, but DNA is imported. Okay, and now again we are going to look at DNA import at the single molecule level. And here, most of the work has been done by a former postdoc, by Kerstin Stingel, and now Steffi Müller has taken over. And there we have collaborations with Dave Dubner from the Public Health Research Institute in New York on Bacillus and with Mike Kumi on Neisseria. Okay, so how can we probe the import of a single DNA? The way we do this is we immobilize a bacterium at a glass cover slide. We can then watch it in a microscope. And then we attach we attach DNA at just one end to a bead, trap this in a laser trap, and then approach it to the bacillus. As the DNA binds, we can pull a DNA tether straight. And now, by just looking at the distance between the bacterium and the bead, we can watch how the bacterium imports DNA. So this is really the import of a single DNA molecule in more or less real time. So what you see is that the DNA import machine is very efficient. Within about a minute, the bacterium takes up roughly 10 micrometers of DNA. Okay, so now I wanted to know, how does the import velocity depend on force? Can this motor also work against an external force? And what you see here in black is a typical DNA import event. This just says how much DNA has already been taken up as a function of time. And here we start at 20 piconewton, and there we have about 60 nanometers per second import velocity. At 60 piconewton, it starts slowing down. At 80 piconewton, it's slower. But definitely, we have strong DNA import. And then we can measure the stalling force. This, for example, is a stalling event where we start at 65 piconewton, and then we increase the force to 95, and then we don't see import anymore. So clearly, the DNA import machine in Bacillus is very strong. However, it's not reversible. So even if we apply a very high force, we cannot extract the previously imported DNA. Okay. Now, Bacillus subtilis is a gram-positive bacterium, and there the DNA import is relatively simple because the DNA has to be imported through just one membrane. But what about the gram-negatives? So the gram-negatives, of course, have to import the DNA through two membranes. And then we have the additional question of whether there's just one machine that takes the DNA and pulls it all the way through both membranes, or whether there is one machine for the outer membrane transport and one machine for the inner membrane transport. And in the second case, we would probably get accumulation of DNA in the periplasm. But then what about Helicobacter? So Helicobacter is the only known bacterium that does not use the type 4 pillow system, but that has somehow adapted a type 4 secretion system. So we wanted to do the experiment with Helicobacter. And it turned out that for Helicobacter, we could do something that we were never able to do for Bacillus. So we could look at the import of fluorescently labeled DNA. So what we did was we covalently bound a dye to the bacterium and then incubated and then treated with DNAs. So we can only see the fluorescence from imported DNA. And then what you see at the cell poles, the bacteria form foci. And about 75% of the bacteria import DNA, which is a very, very high percentage. And this is entirely independent of growth phase. Okay, so is there a specific DNA uptake sequence? We compared DNA uptake from specialist own DNA with DNA from lambda phage, and there is really no difference. So there is no specificity for specialist own DNA. And then, of course, we had to make sure that what we're seeing is really driven by the characterized DNA import system. So we made deletion mutants of COMB4, which is an ATPase, or COMB6, which is supposed to be a second channel. And then for those two, we don't see DNA import, so this is fine. But then when we delete the COMI-C in a membrane channel, then there is no difference to the wild type. So this probably means that the DNA is stuck in the periplasm here. And we wanted to check this, and we did that was to exchange the covalently labeled DNA or covalently bound DNA by an intercalating dye, which is only fluorescent when it's intercalated into double-stranded DNA. And then again, we see the DNA is imported. You see the green spots here, but they will then vanish after varying amount of time, between immediately and 60 minutes. And this means that now we see first the import into the periplasm and then the import from the periplasm into the cytoplasm. So clearly it's a two-step process. And as a control, when we do the same experiment with a COMI-C knockout, which is the inner membrane channel, then the foci do not disappear. So we clearly have a two-step process. And we also see that the DNA specificity for the outer membrane is very low here, but for inner membrane it seems to be high, like in the solids. Okay, and then of course we also characterize the velocity as a function of external force. This is a typical experiment here where we start at 20 piconewton, and positive values mean import, negative mean export. So we get import at 20 piconewton, at 10 it's faster, and then at 40 piconewton we extract the previously imported DNA. So the import here was reversible at around 23 piconewtons. And the major difference to the other bacteria we look at, to Bacillus and Neisseria, is that we have a very high DNA import velocity. This is about 1.3 kilobase per second. Okay, so I've shown you a lot of pieces of the puzzle here. So we have seen that the velocity of DNA import is about 80 base pairs per second in Bacillus and Neisseria. It's much faster in Helicobacter. So this could really be a characteristic of the type 4 pillar system. The maximum forces are kind of different, but they're still all very high forces. So these are all machines that can generate considerable force. The gram negatives show reversible DNA import when we apply force, whereas the gram positive doesn't. And for the DNA specificity, we find it's very high for Bacillus and for inner membrane transport in Helicobacter, but weak for outer membrane transport. And then the rod-like bacteria form the foci at the pole, whereas the round Neisseria forms the foci all over the place. So in conclusion, we think that the inner membrane transport has been really conserved between different species, whereas the outer membrane transport has adapted differently in different species. And then I would just like to mention that the regulation of competence is very, very different in the different bacterial species. Okay, and with this I would like to thank the people who actually did the work. And I've already mentioned their name when I went through the talk. And I would like to thank you for your attention.
There is evolution going on, right? If you think on this, this outer thing, so it's like, do you have any? You said that they're very different, these mechanisms.
Yeah.
Between different species, do you have like an idea like how this would look on a phylogenetic tree or something? So how? Is it something that varies on a very microscopic scale, or depending, say, on different environments that these bacteria live in, or is it something that is more like a characteristic of larger classes, or is that not yet known? So
you're talking about the DNA import system. Well, it's not that like that it's very diverse, so it's really highly conserved between all bacterial species besides Helicobacter pylori. And Helicobacter pylori has adapted a type 4 secretion system, which is very well known, for example, from Agrobacterium tumefaciens, which uses it to Well, this one basically sticks a needle into the cells of a leaf and then exerts, sorry, no, yeah, and then pushes its DNA through. So it uses that one for transformation. So it seems to us that somehow the inner membrane properties are very similar between all the species. And then for the gram positives, of course, that was enough, whereas the gram negative needed an additional system for the outer membrane transport. And obviously, in most species, that's a type 4 pillow system, whereas in Helicobacter, this is a type 4 secretion system.
The type of regulation is very different, right?
Yeah.
Is that highly dependent on the environment or?
Probably. I mean, for Helicobacter pylori, we don't know of any regulation. And this might be because it's the only bacterium in its niche, so it's the only bacterium that manages to live in the stomach. And then Bacillus subtilis is a bacterium that lives in soil, so it has a very complex lifestyle. And this one becomes competent only in the stationary growth phase, and then it's only a couple of percent that become competent. Whereas Neisseria gonorrhea has a DNA uptake sequence. But how this is really related to the lifestyle is very, very difficult to figure out experimentally, I would say.
So it's not possible to take one bacteria and make it live in some other niche and see if it starts sperm sensing or whatever.
No. It's not possible.
I have a technical question, kind of
thing.
In the experiment where you see in Helicobacter these DNA foci, how do you implement it? So the fluorescent dye you use, you have that in the bacteria and it only is fluorescent when it's bound to DNA, or how does it work?
No. First of all, we label the DNA fluorescently. So we started with covalently bound dye. This is just covalently attached to the DNA. And then we have it on the DNA. It doesn't leave it. And in the other experiment, we label the DNA with the dye. And then we let the bacterium take up the DNA.
Okay.
So this tells us that it's taken up as double-stranded DNA. Otherwise, it wouldn't fluoresce. And then since the fluorescence disappeared, this tells us that it's imported into the cytoplasm as single-stranded DNA.
Have you tried to use some first principle physics to model the movement of this phenol?
What? Sorry?
First principle physics, dynamics.
Uh-huh.
To model the movement of this phenol?
Well, we are just collaborating with Stefan Klump to model the tug of war like movement. Is that what you mean by first principles?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems to work, but we don't have the results yet. Yeah, and then of course it will be interesting to look what they see for different conditions, whether they get an optimum number of pili per cell where we would get the highest correlation. And these are things that we could then check experimentally.
When just going back to the beginning of your talk, where you showed that these pili could take a part in the structure formation, and you said, "Well, there is lots of signaling."
In myxococcus, you mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's lots of signaling involved in actually coordinating these different. So that would also have people tried to manipulate that. I mean, so that means there is signaling pathways. There is there's a cascade of intracellular sort of signaling regulatory pathways, and when people could manipulate those or else also the signaling molecules outside the cells.
Yeah.
Is that something that people do?
Yes, they do this a lot. So basically what you need first for the 8 minutes reversals is a clock, of course. And this clock, so this is the clock in Myxo, and this is kind of homologous to the chemotaxis system in E. coli. The difference is that there is negative feedback. Do you know about the chemotaxis system in E. coli, roughly? So there's basically this part, there's not a transmembrane receptor in Myxo, but there is a protein that gets methylated and somehow this sets the probability for the first E to be phosphorylated. And if that one is phosphorylated, it seems to inhibit methylation. This is the difference to the chemotaxis system. And this is what is thought to set the clock. And now people are working on the question as to how this clock really couples to spatially to polarity. And there are many proteins known now which might be involved in setting the polarity, but really the mechanism how this clock couples to spatial gradients here is not known.
But is the clock, I mean, is these 8 minutes or so, is that universal? So that
no, you can manipulate this. For example, if you go for, if you make mutants of this protein, you can go down to 2 minutes, and if you mutate other proteins, you can go to infinitely long.
But like in a colony, does this structure formation depend on that they all have the same amount of minutes, or is that robust to that? I mean, does it make, do they have to really sort of synchronize their act, or is that?
I'm sure this has been looked at. I mean, if you look at these traveling waves, I'm sure this will depend on the duration of the clock or on the period of the clock. And I'm also sure there are experiments, but I don't know about the details of those experiments.
But do you think that they are really sort of synchronizing their clocks are only their phases, so that they go like, or?
Yeah. My guess would be that they probably synchronize the phase.
Well, the clock is already more or less homogeneous.
But I think there are experiments that show that this clock works at the single cell level and you get an average of 8 minutes. But if you have a large population, then these 8 minutes get sharper. And this is one point, and the other point is that they can form these patterns by communicating with each other. So what they do is, let's see, where do I have this picture?
They can't form the column.
I don't have the pole there. Okay, you can imagine there is a pore, and this pore consists of, I think, 8 proteins that will form a ring. And then in Neisseria gonorrhea, this will form spontaneously, but in Myxococcus xanthus, you need an additional protein, which is called TGL, which will lead to the formation of the pore. And this TGL protein is exchanged between the bacteria. So this can go from one bacterium to the other, and this is one signal.
And this probably depends on some threshold density, right? So if they're too dilute, it doesn't go.
Probably, yeah.
Like this is, like many of these signals.
Manipulation for this 8 minutes is genetic manipulation, or?
Yes.
Then if you put like 2 types of species, one manipulated together, so. Get mixed patterns, or?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know whether anybody has ever done that experiment. Could be.
There could be transition to chaos or something like that. In which case, this would be come with a fitness cost.
Yeah. All right.
Thank you.